I am Norm Lowndes and Seeds of Science, connecting kids, plants, and science in the Michigan 4-H Children's Garden, something that we have been doing for quite a while. So let me just give you a quick outline. I'm going to talk a little bit about the 4-H Children's Garden and what it is, how we connect to kids, things that we have learned over the many, many years we've been doing this. Then I'm going to take you on a walk, probably even closer to a run, through the 4-H Children's Garden, because there is no kid on earth that just walks through a garden. It just doesn't happen. Talk a little bit about our program called Seeds of Science and what that is, because it's different than a lot of field trip type programs. Talk about some NSF broader impacts work that we've been doing. Connect back to, in a couple of places here, to Liberty High Bailey's original ideas about working with kids and the little book that he wrote called The Nature Study Idea back in 1905. Talk a little bit about connection to next generation science standards, some reactions, and then looking ahead. So the 4-H Children's Garden on campus at Michigan State University is a tiny little place. The outdoor original 4-H Children's Garden, which is now in its 26th year, is all of a half an acre. The Pete and Sally Smith Schoolyard Demonstration Garden, which is next to it, is another 2,500 square feet, and we have an indoor 4-H Children's Garden, which is all of 1,500 square feet. Total land area that we cover is about two-thirds of an acre. So big is not better, okay? You can do an amazing amount of stuff in a relatively small place. What people have said is our garden has been called the most creative half acre in America. The second quote is from a 10-year-old little boy who was in the garden. And I'd ask people, kids, what do you think of this place? Without a second's hesitation, he looks at me and says, well, this is a magical place of learning. So I wrote it down and use it all the time. It is absolutely considered one of the coolest places on the MSU campus. And I do a lot of work with the teacher education program, so I see all of the senior teacher education students, which is usually about 150 to 200 of them each year. And so they're in their fourth year, and I always ask them how many have visited, and about 60% of them don't even know that it exists. So I generate an honest-to-goodness tear for them because they've missed a great place. And it is considered still to this day, 26 years after it opened, as the premier or one of the two or three premier children's gardens in the world. Our mission, promote understanding of plants and the role they play in our daily lives. And that's really the role they play in kids' daily lives, because we're trying to make that kid-plant, kid-garden connection. We are all about nurturing the wonder in a child's imagination and curiosity, because we know if I can get a kid to ask questions, if I can get a kid to be curious, everything else will fall into place really easily. And then we provide a place of enrichment and delight for children of all ages. And just so you know, the youngest child I've ever met in our garden was 4 days old. The oldest child I've met in our garden was about 101 and was there for her birthday. So our tagline is experience plants. What that immediately suggests is a multi-sensory experience. So, in our garden, and I know there are other garden people here, and a lot of gardens don't have these rules, but in our garden it is always okay to touch any plant. It is okay to rub any leaf. It is okay to smell any flowers. In fact, I will get down on my knees and do it with you. We do ask the kids that visit our garden not to taste. And it's not because we have stuff out there that would be it would hurt them or anything. It's because if I tell kids that they taste everything. And it is just like having grasshoppers go through your garden. There's nothing left. We make a big point that every plant in our garden has a story or multiple stories. And part of what I'm going to do today is tell you some of the stories of those plants. Many of those you know, but how the connecting of the kids. We want everyone to discover how or why plants are important to me personally. Because what we know is when someone does experience plants, they will connect to those plants in a whole new way. That's going to lead to them caring about those plants and other plants and ultimately to action. So if we go all the way back to Liberty Hyde Bailey, one of the quotes he gave is, one cannot understand the world if he or she does not know plants. We all sort of know that, and it's kind of in the back of our head, but we talk about this quite often. And another thing that he said is, I'm always obliged to come back to the simple fact that the child lives in a real environment and that this environment should be known to him or her and appreciated by him or her. And we can do that through gardens. So, how do we connect with kids? Here's some of the basics that we have learned over many, many years. First of all, kids are curious and they're full of wonder. They want to know lots of things, so take advantage of it. They do like to learn, especially if it's fun and it's engaging. They learn based on what they already know. That's something that we all know, but we tend to forget, and it doesn't even matter if you've been a teacher for a long time. You tend to forget that. You need to start at their level and then work up. Another thing that we've learned over the years, and I'm going to come back to this, is learning has a shape, and I'll come back to that. Kids will meet or exceed expectations, so set the bar high, and they will meet it. They want and need hands-on. They love things that are familiar. Now, especially when you get to middle school and high school, every kid will tell you, I don't want anything. I want everything new. Everything has to be cool. That's just not true. Think of the last time you were in a place or in a situation where nothing was familiar with you. That is really, really uncomfortable. So they love things that are familiar. Kids love to be surrounded by plants. They really don't care about adult gardening rules. I work with lots and lots of master gardeners, and the first thing I ask them to do is take all of the gardening rules that they learned and set them down beside them, and they can pick them up afterwards, but when they're working with kids, forget about it, because they don't care. Kids experience things intensely, so if they're going to have an experience with plants, if it is a good experience, it's going to be an intense experience, and it's going to be something that they will remember. If it is a bad experience, it's also going to be an intense experience, and it's also going to be something they remember. So we need to work very hard to make sure those are positive, intense experiences. Kids are amazed by little things. They don't care about the big stuff, for the most part. They're concrete thinkers. So especially if you're working with younger children, it is black, white. It is yes, no, there are no shades of gray. And so you have to figure out, and the shades of gray really don't start showing up until late middle school and into high school. Every kid knows that rules are made to be tested. Well, actually, they probably know they're all made to be broken. And kids notice details and not the vistas. And the best example of that I can give you is if you have a deck on the back of your house and you have folks over and you are taking them out to show them the wonders of your yard or whatever. You're going to go out on the deck and you're probably going to have a beer in your hand or a glass of wine. And you're going to go up to the railing on the deck and you're going to look out there and you're going to say, well, this is what we did over here and this is why we did it. And if it doesn't look so good, this is what we're going to do and explain all that. Kids are going to come flying out as well. They're going to go up to the edge of that railing as well. But first of all, they're going to stop at the railing, they're going to look at that railing, and they're going to see an ant walking across it. They don't care about anything else. That's it. It's the ant. It's the little tiny details. And we have done this in the garden where I have given cameras to adults and kids that come in and ask them, all I want you to do is take pictures of what you're doing. I just want my cameras back before you leave. And look at those two sets of pictures, and they are two different gardens. One with kids. It's all the details, it's all the little things, and they're in the pictures, of course, too. Adults, it's the big pictures, it's the vistas, it's looking out, standing in the treehouse and looking out at the whole garden. So we need to understand that about kids. So if you're going to make that plant-kid connection, encourage curiosity and wonder. You want kids to ask questions, you want to be curious. You yourself have to be amazed by everything. You have to find everything about plants exciting. Connect with your audience. Don't worry about gardening rules. It's okay to have garden failures. What I tell many, and this is especially true when you're working with parents, I tell most parents, I have killed more plants than you've probably ever even tried to grow. It's just what happens, and that's okay. And you got to have fun with it, because if you're not having fun with it, why are you even doing it? So get excited about plants. Things that we come back to over and over and over again. Plants are everywhere. We all know that. They've been here lots, lots longer than we have. They're really cool living things. And there's a number of kids that when you tell them a plant is a living thing, they look at you like, really? It's alive? I thought it was just the animals that were alive. Plants make their own food. You realize, I don't care how rich you are, how powerful you are, how smart you are, you can't do that. If I had a plant sitting here, it would be doing it right now. Kind of cool. Plants interact with insects and animals. We need plants for almost everything. They don't need us, but we need them. So get excited about those things and ask lots of questions. So let me show you how we do this. So I'm going to take you on a walk or a run through the 4-H Children's Garden. This is the original 4-H Children's Garden. We've expanded a little bit beyond that, but it's a small space with lots and lots of little themes in it. So I'm going to take you on a tour, and if you were on a field trip visit, I would take you on a tour and then let you explore some on your own with a scavenger hunt. I'm going to show you some theme areas. I'm going to tell you some of the secrets. I'm going to tell you a few of the stories. I'm not going to let you discover even more on your own because you're physically bound here and not in my garden. Sorry about that one. So, 4-H Children's Garden, dedicated in 1993. You're going to enter the garden through the sunburst entrance, and there's a very specific reason for that. It's because it is the sun that gives life to everything. So that's how we're going to enter into this garden space, into these plants. We're going to walk through the imagination arbor, and once you have gone through that, you can do it before, but for sure, after you go through that, it's okay to act like a kid, think like a kid, be a kid, get excited like a kid. In fact, it's almost required. If you were there as a group, I would take you into the amphitheater and sit you down for just a few moments, just because I know someone out there is really curious. 88 small bottoms fit on those seats. That's 2 busloads. That's how you decide those kind of things. Welcome, introductions, a few of the rules about our garden. The biggest, toughest thing I'm going to ask you to do today, if you were in the garden, is to walk and not run. Because when you run, there's enough uneven surfaces that someone's going to trip, and they're going to fall, and their knee is going to hit my cement, and my cement always wins. And I checked. I only have 2 Band-Aids. First 2 kids get a Band-Aid, after that you're going to bleed. Sorry. We do lunches there. We've had dance there stories. We've even had a few weddings, and those are the weddings that, you know, are following that close line between really, really brave or just plain crazy. So we might stop and look at the ABC kindergarten. So we have plants that start with every letter of the alphabet, from alyssum to zinnia. And so one of the things we have, and I'll show this to you in a little bit, but we have a smart sign or QR code-based scavenger hunt. And when you get to this place in that scavenger hunt, the thing you are supposed to do is to find the plant that starts with the letter of your first name. We have an enchanted garden, enchanted stories and plants. It's a tiny little garden. You can see the plants coming out over the edge of it. So we have zinnia in there, Peter Pan, Coleus, Dragon's Blood, Black Magic. The pumpkin that we have in there is the pumpkin. The story is, and it's my story, I'm sticking to it, and it's not just mine, but that is the pumpkin that in Cinderella, that the pumpkin was made out of that pumpkin. And if you look in there, you can see we have a Harry Lauder's walking stick. Those of you that work with ornamentals have probably never seen that cultivar with the bright green bark. That's what you do when you have a Harry Lauder's walking stick planted where there is a soil fungus that's going to kill it every 5 years and you finally get sick of replacing them. You just get out the brightest green paint you can get and you paint it. In the summertime, you hang CDs from it so it glitters, okay? It's enchanted, what can I say? Guarantee it gets kids interested. You can talk to them about what the plant is and why it's there. We have a perfume garden. Plants that make soaps, shampoos, air fresheners, all of those kind of things. And along the walkway there is the lavender, so we always have kids smell the lavender. And it's always, oh, I love that smell. Oh, we have that at home. We have this here and there. So they're starting to make those connections. And in that garden, there's a plant called the popcorn flower. And so for years, and if you smell the flower, or if you rub the leaves on it, it smells like buttered popcorn. So for years, I would say to kids, I don't understand why a plant would have a flower that smells like buttered popcorn. You know, one day, this little second grader, he looks up at me, doesn't hesitate for a second. He says, well, it's pretty obvious. I said, oh, really? He says, yeah, obviously it's to attract butterflies. All right. We have a milk, meat, and wool garden. So the grass that you see there, there are a number of hybrid clovers that are planted into that as well. That is what? That sheep, or there are stepping stones that are there, are cows, pigs, and other things. That's what they eat in order to make your milk, meat, and wool. It is also the most popular photo spot in the garden. I have tried to talk to the administration that it should be a graduation requirement that you get your photo taken there before you graduate. I haven't gotten any place with that one yet, but I'm working on it. We have an herb garden, but if I tell kids that we have an herb garden, it's kind of like, and it's like, okay, I sort of know what I'm doing. I don't really care. We have a Peter Rabbit herb garden. Almost every kid knows the story of Peter Rabbit, and there is Peter Rabbit in the garden. And the little gate into and out of Mr. McGregor's garden is right behind him, and in the summertime, Peter's little blue coat is hanging on that gate. And you can see some of the plants that are in that garden. One of them is chocolate mint, and this is comments from kids about chocolate mint. I love the taste of chocolate mint because that's when we let them taste. And why does it taste like chocolate? Now you guys know that chocolate mint. If I tell you a good enough story, I can get you to believe it tastes like chocolate mint. It tastes like mint. Okay? Or we'll grow the purple haze carrot. And these are the questions I give. Is it really a carrot? And then inevitably somebody asks, well, does it taste like grape bubblegum? Okay? Kids think black and white. Purple is grape. It's not carrot. And I've had kids argue with me about it. No, seriously. Does it taste like grape bubblegum? I said, here, taste it, even when they're tiny. We have a Harry's Herbology Garden. If there's something that kids are really interested in, take advantage of it. So this is a little greenhouse inside our indoor garden. And some of the plants that are in it, these are plants that you'll find in the Harry Potter books. And so kids make those connections immediately. I've seen kids drag their parents in there and say, you got to see this because this is what's in Harry Potter, and explain the whole thing to them. And I didn't have to say a word to them. Petunia is one of them because his aunt is Aunt Petunia. The kids, they're my favorite color. We have these in our yard. We have a peanut butter and jelly garden. And the plants are growing in a giant peanut butter and jelly sandwich with strawberries oozing out between the pieces of bread. Butterfly garden, which is actually shaped like a butterfly. So there's a butterfly body, butterfly wings, and filled with butterfly plants. We have a Monet bridge and pond. Kids know that the bridge is just so that you can get up on top of it and lay down and reach down and try to touch the water. Adults use it to get from one side to the other, but it's modeled after the bridge in Monet's garden. We have a maze, little tiny maze, Alice in Wonderland maze. The plants in it are arborvitae, characters from Alice in Wonderland. It is a wonderful place to surround yourself with plants. We have a dinosaur garden. Some of the plants in that garden were alive at the time of dinosaurs. How cool is that? How amazing is that? Our ginkgo tree, not ours, but ginkgos were alive. Ferns, equisetum, and then you can find dinosaur plants like dinosaur gourd and dinosaur kale. When that rib cage gets covered up with a dinosaur gourd, kids will sit in there in the summertime. And in a kid's mind, if you're a young kid that's even up to about 6, 7, 8, if I'm sitting in there and it's covered up over top of me, I am absolutely invisible. And I can watch everything that goes on in the garden, and you don't ever even see me. And it's wonderful to watch kids do that. And probably the most kid favorite garden that we have is the pizza garden. It's everything that goes into making up your pizza. So we have wheat, tomato, basil, oregano, peppers. We grow pineapple in it. Sometimes we'll have an olive tree in it, depending on the year, depending on what we're growing. And then my little tiny visitors that are only this tall and can barely talk will ask, okay, that's all cool, but where's the cheese? So we plant nasturtiums, yellow nasturtiums, and always show them that, yes, this is what we have to look like the cheese, but it's an edible flower, so you can take it and pick it and eat it. And they all look at you like, oh my gosh, you can eat that? And then they all want to know, can I do that? Absolutely, you can do that. Or they talk about the tomatoes. I love tomatoes. My neighbor grows tomatoes. And I can imagine this kid going over and talking to the neighbor about it and working with the neighbor. And finally, we have some dance chimes. And the plants around it all have musical names like drumstick, gold stick, sonata mix, piccolo music box. But probably the bigger takeaway from this slide is if you're going to dance on the dance chimes, especially if you're in the children's garden, go for it. Don't mess around. Flying through the air, landing on the dance chimes. Dance. So knowing that kids are interested in plants, we have a program called Cool Kid Plants it's actually a selection program. And these are some of the plants, and I'm just going to show you a couple of these, that kids have selected as favorites. So sensitive plant is the number one kid favorite. Leaves close up just like magic. I poke it, it lies back. Once I turn around, and they pop back out. We made it curl up. I like it because when you tickle it, it closes up. Snapdragon is another one. And with a little imagination, it does look like a dragon. And every kid needs to know that when you squeeze the sides of that flower, it opens its little mouth and it will talk to you. And if you listen really carefully, it will tell you the secrets of your garden. And I will guarantee you that if you show that to a kid, within 15 minutes, they will be back up there trying it out. Now, you do know, of course, that if you really want to hear the good secrets of your garden, you have to leave the flower attached to the plant. You physically have to get down on your hands and knees, make yourself look kind of like a fool, butt sticking up in the air, head down. Then it will tell you the good secrets. If you pick the flower off, it's still going to talk to you, but it's it's not going to tell you all the good stuff. Kids love this kind of stuff. Lamb's ear. We show them, every kid gets to feel this. It's so soft, it can't be a plant. I hear that over and over. Or love in a puff. You have to look inside to discover the secret. Once I show kids that little heart on the seed, I had kids many times tell me, I think it does love me. I really think it does. Trust me, kid, it does. Or pretzel bean. This one, I am absolutely convinced if Dr. Seuss had created a plant, this is what he would create. Just looks like a Seuss plant, and it's just fun. So do the theme gardens work? We spent an entire summer asking our visitors what they did in the garden and what was the favorite part of their garden. We've actually done it a couple of summers. Every group we ask, and we've asked this now probably of 200 or 300 visitors, kids' favorite part of the garden is plants. Comes out first. It's somewhere out of the respondents. Everybody, it's 60 to 70% of the kids list plants as one of their favorite. Plants are cool, awesome, amazing. I showed my mom the red flowers, and I can watch, and I have watched many, many times where a kid will find a plant and go find mom, dad, or whomever and literally drag them over and say, you got to see this because this is just a cool plant. I love plants. I want to grow these plants at home. Or I like plants because they're so colorful and pretty. I take pictures of them. I like the roses because red's my favorite color. I love the flowers because they're pretty, they make me feel good, and they smell good. Sensitive plant again, I like its technique. Looks like it's dead when it closes up, then animals will leave it alone. Looks like grasshopper wings. Think about that for a minute. It's called the Tickle Me plant. So the 4-H Children's Garden is a magical place of learning, and the garden itself and the way the themes are put together and the stories we tell works to get kids connected to plants. If you go back to what Liberty High Bailey said, he said nature study teaches the importance of actually seeing the thing and then trying to understand it. But we do more than just have visitors through. We have programs. These are some of them. So we do butterflies in the garden. That's in our indoor garden. We do garden discovery field trips, which are half-day field trips. We do Seeds of Science field trips, which I'll talk more about. We have a program called Collaborating Classrooms, Camp Monet. So I'm going to talk about Seeds of Science. And what we're trying to do with this program is plant curiosity, nurture kids' wonder, and grow understanding. These are day-long field trips. Seeds of Science, most school groups, classes come for 3 days. And usually teachers look at me and say, how do you get anybody to come for 3 days? That's not our problem. Our problem is how do we have more days? The visits are spaced in time, usually at least a week apart, sometimes 2 weeks. It depends on the teacher's schedule. Focused on science, plants. We spend time talking about how scientists do science, that there is this process. We have a model of it. The activities, we work with the teachers to design them. We have what we call authentic experiments, and I'll show you one of those. We integrate technology, and we're aligned with the standards. So we started this out by asking kids what science is, and these are the answers that you typically get. It's hard. Something I don't do very well. It's boring. That's the worst one. I mean, that one makes me want to just cry. Something we do in the science laboratory, or something that's not connected to what I usually do. It's over there. It's down the hall. It's someplace else, but it's not part of my daily life. When in reality, science is asking questions, discovering answers. Every single one of us do that. Every person does that all the time. And I can give you multiple examples. And it's something that we do every day, and we spend some time with examples with kids. I don't have time here to do that. But we want to connect kids to the science. So some questions that they have asked me and things that I've thought about. What does science look like? Okay, I want to connect to it, but I don't know what it looks like. Can I touch it? Can I play with it? Or is it this thing that I, you know, it's over in that science lab, and so I can't. How does it connect to me? And if, especially as they get to upper elementary and into middle school, why should I care? Okay, if it doesn't connect directly to me, I don't care. And I won't even pretend that I care. So we created this science process model. And that drawing of it is very specifically a living, growing plant for a number of reasons. But science always starts with a question, and I wonder. The way we talk about it is, and we'll do some research, we may have to better define our question, find out what's known about it already, make a hypothesis, we do an experiment, we collect data, we explain data, and we ask new questions. I'm not going to spend much time on it, except I want to look at this. If you look at the first step, ask a question. If you look at the seventh step, ask new questions, it suggests that science has a shape. And the shape that it suggests is a... what? Somebody hears. It's a circle. It looks like it's a circle. You start one place, you end up kind of back at the same place. Except if it's a circle, I'm going to go round and round and round. If I go fast enough, I'll get dizzy and I'll fall over, but I'm never going to get any place. So we got to take that circle, we got to stretch it out. Now, when I'm working with third and fourth graders, the word I'm looking for is not in their everyday vocabulary. You guys could tell me it's a spiral. But what I have to do with kids is say, okay, it's a toy that you have played with. And it's kind of a cool toy because if you have stairs, you can take it to the top step and you can give it a push and it'll climb all the way down. And that is a slinky. So this is the shape of science right there. And as an elementary kid, it's okay to say that the shape of science is a slinky. In fact, it's okay to write that in your hallowed science journal. Because it's words that make sense to me as a kid. The other thing that I tell kids, we emphasize to them at this point, is that we have just given them some really very, 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 very important information. Because when they get home tonight, they're going to get asked the dreaded question. What did you learn in school today? When I tell kids, is look back at that person, don't hesitate for a second, tell them, I learned the shape of science. You don't have to say another word, kid. You're good for a week. Because number one, you answered, okay, parents, how many times have your kids not? And number two, whoever asked you the question could look back at you like you lost your mind. You're good. And then you can go on and explain to them. We have, when we ask kids what they remember about Seeds of Science field trips, about the second or third most remembered and liked thing is the work that we do with them about this model and what science is and what shape it has. It comes up over and over. So it's living, growing, expanding. Ours is, I mean, we're a garden. We do plants. So it has to be a living, climbing vine. That gives it some really interesting characteristics that you can have lots of fun with. So that means that it has roots. So it's rooted someplace back wherever. And it's growing now, and it's going to grow into the future. That's kind of cool. It has shape, color, and probably sound. I asked a group of college students one time I was doing this, talked about the shape, and I asked them, so what color is science? I had one young lady, I believe she was a senior, who in the next 2 weeks, I think she went back to every professor that she had ever had in her first 3 years of college, walked into their office, plunked down, and said, so, what color is science? And so she said some of them looked back at her like she had lost her mind, which she probably had. Many of them had an answer. I think science is a rainbow. I know plant science is green. That's as far as I can get. The other things about it, if it's a growing, living vine that's crawling around stuff, it needs support, it needs care. And then we can ask some other kind of cool questions. Why does it spiral up? How long will it grow? What type of support does it need? Fertilizer? Do you need to prune it? What color? But it grows, it's alive. And we start talking about this resonates with kids in a way you can't even imagine. That they come back and start talking about, and I hear from their teachers, all of a sudden science is a different thing to these kids. It's something that's real and alive, and they start to understand a little bit about it. So as part of these field trips, so we do this, we do a number of what we call authentic experiments. And what I mean by that is they're experiments that are based on research that's going on at MSU. So we do, I'm going to show you the best lettuce experiment. We've done some work with mutant tomato and hornworms. We've done some work with a mint project and using microwave extracted mint out of mint plants and then plated it to see how it worked as an antibacterial agent. We worked with some potato genetics and had the great potato race and a number of other things. But this is our best lettuce experiment we've done with thousands of students. So they grow 6 cultivars of lettuce. The question is, what's the best lettuce for Mrs. Smith's fourth grade class lunch? So they grow the 6, they collect data. So they collect height data, could argue that the tallest is the best, it's going to feed the most. They collect quality data, so how good does it look? If it doesn't look good, it's not going in here. You can tell me that I should eat it, but if it has brown leaves, I'm sorry, not happening. We use photographs to determine a qualitative nutrition value, and the best and every kid's favorite is the taste test. And then based on those four pieces of data, they have to recommend a best lettuce. So this is what some of the data looks like, and we do use spreadsheets to keep track of it. But there's some taste data for the six different lettuces, the six different groups, and then the taste data plotted. The one that you'll notice is the Simpson Elite there. They did not like that. But one of the interesting things that happens with this is most of the time when we're taking this data, I'm projecting, as they're collecting it, writing it down, I'm getting it from them and then typing it in and projecting it up in basically in real time. And so I will have group six over here, which is the Simpson Elite group, and group one over there, which is the Bambino group. And when the Bambino group tastes the Simpson group and I put the numbers up and they're saying it all tastes a one, which is the lowest on the scale, I have had instances where that entire table will stand up, look at that table over there and say, "What is wrong with you? Obviously, you don't know how to taste lettuce." Now, if I can get kids that connected to those plants that they grew, the reality is they put the seeds in the soil. We took the plants and grew them in our greenhouse. They looked at them. This was the second time they've ever even seen them. They own them. They are theirs. Okay? So it's really easy to make that connection, but it's amazing to watch them be so connected to their lettuce. And then what's even more interesting is to watch them then say, okay, now you have to recommend a single best lettuce based on your data. And nowhere in your data does it say who planted it. Sorry, I don't care. I've done it with college students too. They do exactly the same thing as fourth graders. Exactly. It's wonderful. That is very, very fun. Okay, we integrate technology in a whole bunch of ways, because if we don't figure out how technology integrates into plants, plant science, then my opinion is you can't complain about technology being good, bad, or anything else if you haven't figured out how to use it. So we do a lot of things with smart signs or QR codes. I'm going to show you a couple of those. One of the cool, well, let me do it this way. So here is a smart sign. So there's the smart sign. This is in our butterfly stuff, and then it connects to this information. But one of the things that we'll do in the garden, and this is not an example, is we'll have kids write this information. So on some of our cool kid plants, the information is written by kids. What I tell kids is another kid doesn't want to read what I have to write about it. They really don't care. But they want to know what you have to say about it. And so I have a whole series of things that the kids have written about the lettuces that they grew, and they're hilarious. Or we have in the garden a scavenger hunt based on QR codes. The codes are out there. Pull out your phone. You can do the scavenger hunt. Our scavenger hunt has information about the plant that's right in front of you. And as much as we can, we get kids to write that. It has, about the garden, excuse me, has it about the plant. It has what you need to do, because it is a scavenger hunt. It may be taking your picture with it. It may be smelling it. It may even be tasting it. And then it has the next clue. And I will see families in our garden. I just walk out there, and the mom or dad is, it's usually an adult that has the smartphone, because they're not going to let the kid drop it. And the kids will be saying, or the parent will be saying, "Well, we just did three of these. Let's go find the next one." Or, "We just did the whole scavenger hunt. We need to bring somebody else over here to see it, because this is really cool. And did you know?" I have a set of 20 iPads that we use all the time, and I just thought this picture kind of summarized technology integration into the garden. So the one little girl there in the front is into it big time and using it. The two behind her are either arguing about who's next or just talking in general. And the third one in the background is, the whole technology thing has given them a headache. Okay? You guys have all been there. You understand? Okay, so that's kind of the way it works. We have figured out how to work out most of the bugs of that, so it works pretty well. We use it a lot for kids to take pictures. And so that if a group is there, they take pictures. By the time they get back to school, those pictures are uploaded to a Google photo album, and the link is sent to the teacher so that they can continue to use them, and they do use them. So back to Bailey. He said, "Every child should have the handling of at least one plant during the period of childhood. One plant cannot be handled without leaving an impression on the life." So the other thing that we do with Seeds of Science, and actually we do this with every single kid that comes through a field trip or visits the garden, and usually I do this when I go and give talks, is every kid gets to transplant a seedling and take it home with them. So you're going to take a piece of our garden, and you're going to take that with you, and you're going to grow it. When I see these kids, and they will come up to me any place they see me. So it's quite often someplace in public, in the mall or whatever, and they come running up to me, and the very first thing they have to tell me about is their plant that they're growing. I have had teachers come back to me a year and a half after I had given them a plant for their room to tell me that their plant is still growing. I immediately grab their hand and start checking out their green thumbs and that sort of thing, because they say, mine's long gone. But kids love to grow plants, and it really doesn't matter what age they are. I've done this with elementary, middle, and high school kids. The only way you get high school kids more interested is if you start throwing $10 bills at them, but that's about the only way. So I mentioned, and I have to say something about Next Generation Science Standard, because that's what the teachers are focused on. Most states are adopting them. There are plant investigations at each grade, which is a cool thing, and I can give you the list and tell you what they are if you want to know. The whole idea is based on is this idea of phenomenon, so things that happen in nature. Let's look at those, let's start asking the questions, and let's start doing our discovery from that. And phenomena happen everywhere in the garden, all the time, every day. We have spent some time and spent time working with some of our teacher education folks to take the Next Generation Standards and that science model that I showed you and mapping those two, and they map up very nicely, and so we're doing some interesting things with that. Kids don't care about this part, but we have to do it for the teachers, and they need to be able to demonstrate these connections. So one of the niches that we have found at MSU is there are lots and lots and lots of plant scientists doing some very basic plant science research, getting lots and lots of dollars from National Science Foundation or National Institute of Health. National Science Foundation has a requirement in your proposal that you have a broader impact statement. It's not just a statement anymore. It's a paragraph or even a half page or sometimes even a full page. How are you going to get this information to the general public, and part of the general public is kids? So what folks at MSU have figured out is that's what we do. We work with kids. So we get calls frequently as people are putting together their grants to, can you help us with this broader impact? So these are some of the things that we've worked on. So some stuff with potato genetics, mint, corn, mutant tomatoes, petunia, Arabidopsis. And the way that we do this is we have a science demonstration or science discovery garden in the 4-H Children's Garden. So we will put plants out there. We will add a little bit of additional signage. Generally in our garden, the only signage are the plant names. But we do have names on all of our plants. We do, as part of Seeds of Science, we incorporate activities and discoveries into those visits that are based on these different grants that we're working on. We'll do experiments with them. And one of the things that we're trying to do more and more and more of is just get the scientists in the room. You don't have to come for a long time. You can only spend 5 minutes in the classroom with a whole bunch of little kids so that they can see you, and especially when the scientists are persons of color and women. We want to get those folks in front of this group, these groups of kids, and say, these are the scientists that are doing this stuff. This is cool stuff. This is happening right now in the lab that's just over there, but you're doing something that's based off that. The mutant tomato work, it's tomato that doesn't have trichomes and has no smell. And so hornworms attack it like you can't even imagine. So this experiment that we've done with kids is caging regular tomato and mutant tomato, introducing hornworms, weighing the hornworms before you put them in, weighing the plant, or getting an estimate of the green on the plant before they went in, cage everything up, and then a week later the kids come through, open them up, they determine the amount of leaf area that's left, but the more fun part is weighing the caterpillars and measuring how long they are. Okay? They start to get it. Oh my gosh, this is what's going on here. So it's really interesting in the write-ups that we've given to as part of the annual reports to NSF. They're really loving it. So does seeds science connect kids to plants? Short answer is yes, but let's take a quick look at what some kids have to say. I love this place. That's about the garden and what we're doing. Can't we come here every day? No, you can't come every day. Sorry. I don't want to leave. Plants are really cool. These are the ones that get me. I want to learn everything about plants. I saw a plant problem in my backyard. So this kid's taking it home. I think it was powdery mildew, and we do a plant problems thing. And one of the problems that we talked about and looked at under the microscope and had pictures of, high magnification picture, that was powdery mildew. And this kid was absolutely convinced that he or she had it in their backyard. Or, I want to be a plant scientist. I see that frequently. Why do butterflies not come out at night? Why do you like science so much? Don't get me started. You'll never shut me up. Why do you like plants so much? So it's getting across that we like plants a little bit. When did you start to do science? How do plants get their colors? Why is the garden so big? Or the next question is, why can we see the whole thing? Why is it so small? What's a seed's shell made from? Where do seeds come from? And that one they can usually answer. Can you break a seed? That was the kid that broke, you all know this kid that breaks everything. So anyway. What does a plant look like inside the seed? And we do that typically with them. Or what did the first plant look like? That one kind of goes back to the other thing that kids will ask me quite often is, how old are you? And it's not always connected with what did the first plant look like. But I tell them, I'm really, really old, but I'm not that old. Come on. So you get lots of things. Teacher reactions. I really enjoyed all the organized lessons, technology integration. It was done well. Diverse experiences. My students loved it. I love how involved the kids are. They get to do science. We do science. We don't talk about science. We do it. If you're coming on a field trip to do Seeds of Science with us, you're getting your hands dirty. I'm not apologizing for it. In fact, if you're not getting them dirty, I'm going to get them dirty for you. I also like how the weeks build on each other. I like the hands-on learning engagement. He showed us once again, I love this one, that this is the best field trip anywhere, any place. This was not solicited. This came in after the fact. And that includes our annual field trip to Comerica for a Tiger baseball game. Now, granted, the Tigers are pretty pathetic, but, I think they were good at this time. Anyway, or this one here, and this was from a friend of ours. My son can't stop talking about photosynthesis. And that went on for about 3 weeks. Best field trip my kids have been in. It was a pleasure and learning experience to be a chaperone. Thanks. So, two stories. One is a 10-year-old visitor early on in the history of our garden. Little girl came with her mom and her grandma. The garden had only been open for about a year, so they were coming up to see it. Her mom worked for Extension. Spent 3 or 4 hours in the garden, going through, exploring everything, dancing on the dance chimes, going up in the treehouse, all that kind of stuff. But what she noticed is that one of the interns that was working in the garden was a college-aged young lady. And she said to herself in her head, she says, that's what I want to be. That young lady has, for the last 10 years, been the education coordinator for the 4-H Children's Garden. She was an MSU student. She was an intern in the garden when she was an MSU student, and now she is delivering the education to thousands of kids every year. The other story is one that I just happened this spring. So I, like I said, I work with the teacher education program. I see all those kids. I get them for a 3-hour field trip. I take them out in the garden, and we do all kinds of fun stuff with them. After the field trip, I had one young lady come up to me, and she kind of pulled me aside, and she said, I got to tell you. She said, I came here on a field trip, a Seeds of Science field trip, when I was in 4th grade. She said, it was cool. I remember it. She said, a big part of the reason that I am planning to be an elementary science teacher is because of what we did on that field trip. It's probably the first time I've been able to tell that story without my voice completely cracking up. But that's the kind of impact that we can have. So it's pretty amazing. So I'm going to leave you with a challenge. And my challenge is that every person here needs to help connect kids and plants. So some simple things to do. First of all, take some time to show kids how cool and interesting plants are. Get down on your knees with them. Sit down with them in the garden. Show them. Get excited about the little things that plants do. When you see bugs on plants, when you see aphids on them, stop and show them. How many of you have ever stopped and watched a ladybug take out aphids? It's like way cool. It's like a train wreck you can't look away from. Kids love it. First thing they want to know especially if they're a little older, is they'll be pulling out their phone and videotaping the whole thing. So then you can watch it over and over. Share your, you guys are all working with plants. You have cool plant stories. You're doing amazing stuff with it. Share those stories with kids, with teachers. Garden with kids. You don't have to do much. Just even if you just take them out in the garden. Connect with us to deliver your stories. If you're really worried about it, if you're scared to death about being in front of a bunch of kids, we'll hold your hand. We'll help you out. And visit. Come and visit us. We would love to have you. Let me know you're coming. I'll give you a personal tour. I'll show you. I'll tell you most of the secrets of our garden. I'll tell you whatever lies you need to hear. Because there is something called the wonder of plants. I truly believe it. So if you look at a plant or a garden, but look at a plant through a child's eyes, it is magic. It is wonder. And it's full of surprise. And with that, I will end and be glad to entertain any questions, comments, or thoughts. Thank you.
Anybody have any questions? If you could come up to the microphone so that it will record your questions. Yeah, there's...
You got to work for your question here.
I did. I'm writing it. Thanks very much. I was just curious. I live in Reno, further north out of here. And so I'm curious how you and your organization deal with the seasonality of your garden, how open hours shift, and if your programming changes through the season, and how you integrate that with school visits because they're not there during the summer, which is when a lot of garden stuff is going on.
Okay, really good questions. Most of our field trips happen in September, October, and in butterflies is March, April, and then we do Seeds of Science again in May. Those times of year, we have kids in our garden every single day. Somewhere a light day will be 60 kids, a heavy day will be 150 kids. Most of them there are there all day. We do a series of family programs in the summer to get people in, and that's all we can do. We don't do a lot in the winter, but most of the schools, because of the seasonality, because of our seasons, aren't doing plant stuff in the winter anyway. We can do stuff online. We can Skype in. We can make some visits. We do some. We've done the best lettuce experiment in the middle of the winter, as long as you have some lights. So that's how we handle it.
Where's most of your funding typically come from?
The question was, where does most of our funding come from? There is a Michigan 4-H Foundation, and that is how the original funds were raised and is still the fundraising arm of our garden. I talk to lots and lots of donors and, you know, tell them sad stories and work up tears and bring little kids in front of them. I tell them usually the story of, I had a little second grader who came for a butterflies field trip, and about a month later I got a phone call. It was his mom, and said, my son wants to make a donation to the 4-H Children's Garden. He came on a field trip for butterflies, and he wants to give you a donation. We give him an allowance every month. He has saved up $10. Whoops, there it is. To help plants and pollinators, MSU 4-H Children's Garden. I was from a second grader. He came in and gave me the bag. Most of it was change. I think there was $1 bill in it. Now, those $10 aren't going to get me very far very fast. But and then with the NSF grants, the investigators write in a little portion of salary, like a month or two of salary for my education coordinator. So it comes from a number of sources. We're working on building the endowment so that we're fully funded.
Thank you very much. Very interesting presentation. I was wondering, based on your experience, how important is the design of the garden in terms of the making kids excited about it and learning better, and how you show the interaction of different plants, because they, some of them they like shade, some of them they grow together better. How we can show that interaction? And the reason I'm asking is that I'm also establishing, started this year, an indigenous garden, sort of native plant garden, and want to use that towards the education of the children. And we see that the design is very important, and how these plants growing together, or some of the plants they're matching with each other better, working together. Some they need a little shade, some they work better in certain areas, some they need more water, sort of they growing better close to the sort of water. Just once.
Well, the design is crucial, and that's why we do theme gardens. Because then I can have a garden that is based on a theme that kids understand. The first thing, though, above all, and never forget this, whatever you're doing with the garden, it is first and foremost a garden. Okay? Plants have to be first and foremost. I have been in, I don't even know how many, I've been in many, many, many children's gardens. Most children's gardens, when you go into them, the plants are not labeled. What that says to a kid, you might not realize this, but kids get the message real quickly, they're not very important. Other stuff has labels, but the plants don't. That's a huge, gigantic, enormous, colossal mistake. So, the design is important. You got to have the flow through it. We do it with themes because it's very easy for me to connect kids. It's kid-based themes, and so it's easy for me to connect the kids up. We will add some shade structures. We'll do the best that we can to so that all the different plants can grow in the area, but if all of them can't grow, I'm okay with that. We're going to grow what will grow the best and what can the kids can connect to, and we'll talk about why the other ones weren't growing that. We can explain all of that. So that's how we approach it. But the themes are vitally important, and you got to put names on them. And just so you know, in our children's garden, there's not a single scientific plant name. It's not because we don't know them. It's because when I was first there, I watched what happened when people came in. And when a parent or parents would come in with a small child, and the child would ask what that name was, if it looked like a scientific name, or if it was a scientific name, about 75%, rough estimate, of the parents would look at it and say, I don't know. Because somewhere in the back of their head, their vision of science was, it's this huge body of knowledge, and I got to get it right, and somehow if I don't get it right, something really bad is going to happen. I'm not sure what it was, but something bad was going to happen. To the point where about the third year I was there, we had a scientific name on some plants right at the entrance, and about 8 feet down, there was a common name that I literally took vowels out of it so it was not pronounceable, and watched what happened. Kids would ask about the first name. Parents would say, I don't know, and they'd keep going. They'd ask about the second name that was obviously a common name, and the parents would stumble all over it even though you couldn't pronounce it. So we have never since then put a scientific name in our garden, but we do have names on all of our plants because the plants are important. So
I just want to make a quick comment about working with kids and gardens internationally. So USAID and other donors, we've invested a fair amount of money in the past with the World Vegetable Center to do school gardens, mm-hmm. In elementary school systems around the world in some very poor countries. And, of course, the kids get very excited about it. They like to get their hands dirty. Visitors come and they can show what they've been growing. But, and then they actually incorporate the vegetables into the yep. school diet because mm-hmm. the micronutrient level yep. delivery is crucial. But we find that the really important thing is we find that these systems aren't successful unless we want the kids to bring the vegetables home to the parents, because the parents are typically, they're just growing rice or maize. And we use, the project really isn't considered successful unless there's some sort of a through the conduit of the kids getting excited about it in the school, then the parents will start to diversify their production of a crop and then try to grow vegetables due to the... I don't know if you have any insight on that, or I don't know, in developing countries, getting the parents involved is probably not as much of a goal, but it is internationally.
Well, and it actually is with a lot of school gardens. I was just at the National Children and Youth Garden Symposium last week, and so there's lots of school gardens in the U.S. that's the way they're measuring success, or one of the ways they're measuring success as well, is what are the kids bringing back, the ideas that they're bringing back to the family, or the changes in fruits and vegetables that they might look for at the store and that sort of thing. One of the things that's we've played around with a little bit, and I was talking with some folks that are doing a little bit more with it last week, is the whole idea of, when I showed the smart signs and the information, of having kids put together information about the plants that they're growing in their garden in such a way that it could even be information that could go home on a card to parents or something like that. You've got the kids engaged because they're writing it, and I could get them to write all day if I had to, just by making a big deal out of the fact that I was going to take this card to ASHS Symposium and I'm going to hold it up in front of, 200 people. They would do anything for me to get that. So anything you can do to have them engaged in not only the planting and the growing, but putting together the information, the understanding, and why is it important to me? And if I can write it down, then I've got it up here, and I can take it home, and I can talk to my parents about it, and I can answer their questions, and I can... So there are a number of schools, and I could get you a list, or at least some people, that are looking at that piece of it as a measure of... So what do the kids take home? How does the diet at home change as a measure of the success of their school garden? Ours is a little different because we don't... With our themes, we don't grow enough to feed anybody anything. that's the way ours is put together. But that's a really good point, and that is a different component internationally. Much of it is different internationally than domestically, but there are some gardens that are really looking at that.
Thank you, Dr. Lowndes, for your wonderful presentation and also for the work that you're doing. Thank you so much. So at this point, we're going to begin our awards program, and our first award is a Hall of Fame award. As you know, the Society gives its most prestigious award to honor distinguished persons who have made monumental and unique contributions to horticulture. We offer the Horticulture Hall of Fame to educate and increase the awareness of our younger members of the profession and the general public about the important contributions of horticultural pioneers who have made significant impacts on horticulture. ASHS is exceptionally pleased to induct an outstanding contributor to horticulture into the Hall of Fame this year. It's a great pleasure and honor for me to present this year's ASHS Horticulture Hall of Fame Award to Walter Tennyson Swingle. And Walter's son, Frank, and his grandson, Frank, are here to accept the award for their dad. Swingle is among the first USDA plant breeders. His cross produced Carrizo and Swingle, the most important U.S. citrus rootstocks, grown on more than 400,000 acres. His citrus hybridization created new categories such as Tangelos, which is grapefruit by tangerine cross. Swingle was an early advocate for permanent living collections of crop plants and relatives and helped plan the U.S. Plant Introduction Station. He identified dozens of new citrus species and several genera, and produced the most important taxonomic treatise on Rutaceae. Swingle was a USDA plant explorer for several years and the USDA Germplasm Resources Information Network lists him as the collector on 2,054 accessions. He collected and established medjool and deglec-nor dates, earning the designation of Father of the U.S. Date Industry. He introduced clementine, a parent of many citrus cultivars. Swingle identified dozens of new species and several new genera and is the cited taxonomic authority. The genus Swinglea was named in his honor. He assisted the Library of Congress to obtain more than 100,000 volumes for their Asian collection and authored more than 250 publications. Please join me in honoring Walter Tennyson Swingle with our society's highest recognition.
I'm very proud to accept this for my father. In all of his accomplishments, he was a great father. When our first grandchild was born, my name is Frank Swingle, and this child pronounced Frank as Geek. And I was known as Geek for 40 years from all my grandchildren and their spouses and their children. And I was quite upset recently to run into a paper about the limequat. I always knew that my father had produced the limequat, which is a cross between the lime and the kumquat. But this particular article was titled, Limequat, a delicious fruit for part of the citrus family. And the fruit geek, he produced it. My father was not a fruit geek. That's all I have to say.
There are members of the society who have made such outstanding contributions to horticulture in research, teaching, extension, or administration on the national and international levels. We are pleased to be able to honor some of those folks through fellows recognition. And so we are moving on in our presentations now to our fellows. And this year we have several fellows that we would like to recognize. This is the 55th class of fellows of the American Society for Horticultural Science. And I would ask that as I present your name, please come to the stage and I will give a short biography and then we have a plaque to present to you. Our first fellow is Gary Bachman from Mississippi State University. Gary is highly respected and well-known by his peers at the state, regional, and national and international level as an outstanding extension specialist and educator in regards to ornamental horticulture. In his role as an extension educator, he is recognized as having made tremendous impacts with consumers of horticultural products and services. He is recognized as the voice and face of the award-winning Mississippi State University Extension Services, Southern Gardening, television, newspaper, and radio. These highly effective extension outreach programs use mass media to teach and educate the general public to be successful in many concepts of horticulture. The Southern Gardening newspaper column has a reach of up to 1.5 million indirect contacts per week. He consistently produces highly effective extension education products for the consumer horticulture public. Since becoming the host and face of Southern Gardening in 2010, he has received more than 35 awards for producing outstanding communication products on a state, regional, and national level. Our next fellow is Nala Basil from USDA ARS National Clonal Germplasm Repository. Nala Basil is a molecular plant geneticist with the United States Department of Agriculture National Clonal Germplasm Repository in Corvallis, Oregon. Since starting with the NCGR in 2002, her primary research focus has been molecular marker development and application to germplasm management and diversity evaluation. Nala developed the first microsatellite markers in blueberry and hazelnut. Her fingerprinting sets for these crops are now used worldwide for identity confirmation. In addition to this work, she developed and applied molecular tools for germplasm characterization in strawberry, red and black raspberry, blackberry, pear, medlar, quince, hops, and mint. Her work on marker development and characterization resulted in the first tetraploid blueberry map. In Rosebreed, a specialty crop research initiative, she led the team in the development of the first throughput genotyping array in an octoploid organism, the domesticated strawberry, and the first arrays in cherry, peach, and apple. She led the genomic team of the work of the Black Raspberry SCRI-funded project that resulted in the first chromosome-scale genome sequence in rubus. Nala Basil is a shining star and esteemed scientist within our horticultural community. Our next fellow is Susan Brown, and Susan was not able to be here today, so Thomas Bjorkman will be coming to accept the award for her. Susan Brown is a leading apple breeder and geneticist noted for developing apples that satisfy both the grower and the consumer. Brown has released 4 apple varieties. She has made several key discoveries in the genetic control of tree form, resulting in trees that require less labor in the orchard while maintaining high yield, as well as trees that are distinctive landscape ornamentals. She has also discovered biological mechanisms and underlying phenolic synthesis, various disorders, fruit texture, and flavor. In addition, she is the inventor or co-inventor of 10 sweet cherry varieties suitable for the challenging growing conditions of the East. Brown has contributed as a leader, including being director of the New York State Agricultural Experiment Station in Geneva, providing a rich environment for horticultural research to thrive. She worked with stakeholders in industry, in government, and at the university to build a strong future for the institution in a constantly changing environment. So is Thomas close by here? Yeah. Our next fellow is Xinao Ding. Xinao Ding is a professor of environmental horticulture at the University of Florida. He's focused his research on breeding and or genetics of horticultural crops, including caladium, citrus, coreopsis, gerbera, lantana, impatiens, and petunia. He's published 90 refereed articles. Ding discovered multiple sources of resistance to major caladium and Gerber diseases and incorporated the resistance into new cultivars. Over the last 15 years, he's released 37 new cultivars in caladium, gerbera, and lantana, received 31 plant patents, and established more than 50 license agreements for commercial production of these cultivars. He's elucidated the inheritance of important horticultural and disease-resistant traits in caladium and gerbera and developed linkage maps of the genes controlling these traits. The biotechnological tools he developed have been used by him and others to accelerate the genetic improvement of horticultural crops. He's received $5.9 million in research grants and delivered more than 70 invited lectures and presentations at international, national, and regional conferences and research institutions. Our next fellow is Ralston St. Hilaire. Ralston St. Hilaire is professor and head of plant and environmental science and interim head of extension plant sciences at New Mexico State University. His research focuses on ornamental plant development, water conservation in desert environments, and drought stress physiology. He is a PI or co-PI on funded proposals that have totaled more than $12 million. He served as major advisor to 13 graduate students. He was awarded the Distinguished Research Award from the NMSU College of ACES and the Research Discovery Award from NMSU in recognition for outstanding achievement in research and discovery. As an educator, he developed 6 new courses at NMSU related to landscape and environmental horticulture and environmental stress physiology. His teaching innovations include an educational model to co-instruct 2-year college and 4-year university courses in a synchronous environment, an outdoor classroom dedicated to teaching landscape irrigation, and Southwest Plant Selector, a mobile application for iPhone, iPad, that delivers plant selection information to students and consumers. St. Hilaire has contributed extensively to international horticulture. He has mentored and or recruited graduate students from India, Iran, Jordan, Pakistan, and Trinidad, hosted a Fulbright scholar from Jordan, and has actively collaborated has active collaborators in Mexico. He is the incoming ASHS International Division Vice President. All right, and so for our fellows, I believe we are going to do pictures later, so in case you're wondering. Okay, for all of the award winners. So at this point, I would like to introduce Dr. Mike Arnold, who chairs the ASHS Awards Committee, and let him make our next award presentations.
Thank you, Dr. Cole. This fun part of the program, we get to give out awards, so it's a great time to be up here. Each recipient of the Career Awards this year will be receiving an engraved mantle clock in recognition of their achievements, and these have been sent to their offices so they don't have to haul them back on the plane. It's my privilege to announce the ASHS Career Awards for 2019. The first of these is the Outstanding Undergraduate Educator Award. This award is presented for distinguished contributions to the undergraduate education in horticulture science. The award is presented this year to Dr. Thomas Michaels from the University of Minnesota. Dr. Michaels here?
Yes.
Dr. Michaels places a high priority on innovation in his teaching. He transformed the high enrollment introductory plant propagation course from a traditional course to a hybrid course with online lectures, homework assignments, quizzes, and social networking forums while retaining the popular face-to-face laboratory sections. He's been an early adopter of teaching in active learning classrooms, the first in prototype rooms, and later in the university's flagship active learning classroom building that was based upon these early prototypes. Dr. Michaels has also provided service to the university through his leadership in the Senate subcommittee. The subcommittee is established to address classroom planning, management, and renovation, and has served as the primary faculty mentor for 15 to 20 students annually. And he's serving as a support person for 5 faculty mentors and 2 college advisors in the major. So he's a very busy individual. Please join me in congratulating him on this award. Our next award, Career Award, is the Outstanding Graduate Educator Award. This is for distinguished contributions to graduate education in horticultural science. The award this year is presented to Chen Yang Yu from University of Minnesota. Do I notice a University of Minnesota mafia going on here? Okay. Is Dr. Yu here? Dr. Yu is the first holder of the Bachman Endowed Chair in Horticultural Marketing at the University of Minnesota. Over the last decade, she's advanced and emerged the emergent fields of horticultural marketing and behavioral economics through her scholarship and graduate teaching and mentoring. In courses, she has strived to develop a student-centered learning environment that incorporates in-class games and experiments with discussion, guest lectures, and field trips. She's received consistently excellent student evaluations for her classes, and 100% of her students would recommend her as an instructor to other students. Quite impressive. She's been a popular and prolific graduate mentor, having co-advised or co-advised 10 MS for PhD students, and these to completion in the Applied Plant Sciences and Applied Economics graduate programs. She's also served on 10 additional graduate committees and currently advises 5 MS and 4 PhD students. Let's congratulate Dr. Yu on her award. Our next career award is for the Outstanding Extension Educator Award. This award is for exceptional contributions to the profession and science of horticulture, the horticulture industry, and to our home and urban horticulture through innovative extension programs. This year's award goes to Dr. Brian Wipker from North Carolina State University. Dr. Wipker has had a noteworthy career in floriculture research and extension. A characteristic that has made his extension programs so effective is his systems approach to the issues. His contribution has provided permanent resources in plant health, nutrition, and growth regulation for the floriculture industry. His accomplishments can be measured in the number of people he serves and those he mentors. His dedication to growers is palatable, and their respect and admiration for him is very clear. He's also an outstanding mentor both to students and colleagues, and is recognized as an outstanding mentor to other extension educators. He genuinely cares about his colleagues and the growers they serve, and he's dedicated to developing diagnostic tools which these growers can use immediately to solve problems, and has an outstanding record of achievement and positive impact on growers, students, and the colleagues he serves. Join me in congratulating Dr. Rickert. Our next award is for the Outstanding Research Award. This one's got quite a lengthy description. It's described as a distinguished award for research in one or more horticultural crops or plants, and of research that has made a significant contribution to scientific knowledge, basic or applied, dealing with or applicable to improvements in the breeding, selection, propagation, quality harvesting, processing, marketing, or use of horticultural crops, plants or products thereof. This award is presented this year to Dr. Yang Ungulu with the USDA's ARS service. Dr. Sunny Liu has been on the forefront of research and providing critical data to assist the fresh produce industry and to meet regulatory expectations of controlling food safety hazards through production systems. As an extremely dedicated and tireless research scientist with the USDA's ARS, she has received national and international recognition for her work in fresh produce safety and quality. Her expansive research portfolio and the findings have significantly impacted food safety policies and practices in both the United States and internationally. Her record of research is extraordinary for its practical significance. That is, she has worked on preventing preventative controls in scaling up processes relative to the industry, all while keeping an eye on the effects of the interventions on product quality. The close connection of her research to the issues faced by the fresh produce industry is impressive. The outcomes of her research has advanced horticultural science and have benefited the industry. Congratulations, Dr. Liu. Our final career award that we'll be giving out is for the Outstanding International Horticulturalist Award. This recognizes an international horticulturist who has made an outstanding and valuable contribution to international horticultural science, education, research, and outreach. The award is presented to Dr. John Bowman from the United States Agency for International Development. Dr. Bowman is a senior agricultural advisor and program area leader at the United States Agency for International Development's Bureau for Food Safety, Security, excuse me. He's leader for the Nutritious and Safe Foods Program Area at BFS and has been working on the Feed the Future initiative since 2011. He manages global projects for USAID's Office of Agricultural Research and policy and in the areas of horticulture, integrated pest management, food safety, and post-harvest loss. He's recently joined the BFS Youth Learning Agenda Task Force and is highly interested in bringing more youth engagement in USDA's research portfolio. Good news for all the young folks. He has more than 30 years of experience in international development and having worked in more than 40 countries for international agricultural research centers. Congratulations, Dr. Bowman. Well, I think we're going to switch gears now. Is that correct, Dr. Cole? We're going to begin to present some of the individual awards for papers, outstanding papers. Each year, the Society recognizes outstanding manuscripts that have been published in the Society's Journal of the American Society for Horticultural Science, Hort Science, or Hort Technology during the previous year. This morning, I would like to announce the recipients for research published in 2018. These researchers have done an outstanding job and deserve more respect. Please come to the, much respect. I guess they get more as well. please come to the stage as I announce your award. Each recipient will have a plaque that will have been sent to their offices, but we'd like to come up and be recognized as well. The first of these publications awards is the Vegetable Publication Award for the most outstanding paper on vegetable crops. This year's recipients are Dr. Christopher D'Angelo and Erwin Goldman for their manuscript entitled Temporal Aspects of Vernalization and Flowering in Long-Day Storage Onion, published in the Journal of the American Society for Horticultural Sciences. Apparently they couldn't be with us today. Well, we'd like to congratulate them anyway. We'd congratulate more if they're here, right?
Right.
Okay. Yeah. Let's move on to our next publication is the Fruit Publication Award. This is for the most outstanding paper on fruit crops. This year's recipients are Dr. Marlene Ayala and Gregory Lang, for their manuscript entitled Current Season Photosynthate Distribution in Sweet Cherry, and this was published in the Journal of the American Society for Horticultural Sciences. Our next paper is the Cross Commodity Publication Award. This is for the most outstanding paper on horticultural cross-commodity research. This includes broadly applicable methodology in pre- and post-harvest physiology, genetics, anatomy, morphology, ecology, crop production systems, modeling, and management. This year's recipient is Dr. Eric Brennan, for his manuscript entitled The Slide Hammer Seeder, A Novel Tool for Planting Small Seeds. This was published in Hort Technology. Sounds like an interesting development.
Well, I'm not Eric, but on his behalf.
Okay. Thank you.
Thank you.
Our next award is for the Ornamental Publication Award for the most outstanding paper in floriculture, ornamental horticulture, and landscape horticulture. This year's recipient is Dr. Jennifer Bolt for the manuscript entitled Short-Term Reductions in Irradiance and Temperature Minimally Affect Growth and Development of Five Floriculture Species. This was published in Hort Science. Our next publication is the Extension Publication Award for the most outstanding paper in horticultural extension. This year, the recipient is Dr. Arthur DiCatano for a publication entitled Regional Influences of Mean Temperature and Variance Changes on Freeze Risk in Apples. This was published in Hort Science. Yes.